Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, April 18th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm joined this week by Lee Wilkins and frequent guest panelist Linda Kraxberger. Linda chairs the Convergence faculty at the Missouri School of Journalism. We lost a faculty colleague this week. Emeritus Professor Joy Patterson, as one contemporary put it, invented the teaching of science journalism. Joy no doubt would have approved our first topic, Frontline's excellent documentary last night on the sometimes shaky science behind criminal forensics. Expert testimony is also a part of this week's court hearing to determine whether Ryan Ferguson will get a new trial. Ferguson was convicted of murdering Columbia Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt in 2001. The Los Angeles Times reports today that American soldiers posed for photos with the dismembered bodies of Afghan bombers. Two of those photos appear on the front page of the paper and on the Times website, raising questions about whether and when it's appropriate to publish graphic images of violence. The 2012 Pulitzer Prizes were announced this week, including one for national reporting to the Huffington Post. In fact, the online efforts of both traditional and non-traditional news organizations won increasing favor this year from the Pulitzer Board. If you haven't had a chance yet to watch it, we recommend you go online to check out last night's Frontline documentary on PBS called The Real CSI, How Reliable is the Science Behind Forensics? We have the video embedded in our blog, and there's also a link to the full experience at pbs.org. That program makes several key points about the use of forensics in criminal trials. Here are some of them. That some techniques, like the science of bite marks or the smell of death, are questionable or at least untested in courtrooms. That it's hard to know who's really qualified to be an expert witness, especially when it's easy to buy a certificate from the largest organization that gives its seal of approval to such things. That national standards are needed for some of the forensics accepted as evidence in court, and that most criminal defendants can't afford the cost of challenging the prosecution's science experts. Well, Lee, before we get into the details about the documentary itself, let's talk a little bit generally about what's called the CSI effect. That is, that TV police procedurals like CSI make scientific evidence in criminal investigations seem 100% accurate. And also, there's this impression that even juries have the expectation these days that scientific evidence or the lack of it actually is enough to determine whether you're guilty or not.
I know of no study that looks at what it is that juries expect. It would be a great study for someone to do. Of course, you wouldn't be able to poll people who've actually been on juries. You'd just be able to poll people and do some extrapolating. Having said that, there are a couple of longstanding studies that seem to have held up now for decades, which is the two most damning things that can happen to you in the criminal justice system and that come up at trial, all right, are one, you can confess. And once you've done that, people tend to think you're guilty. The second thing is you can get arrested. People tend to think that if you've been arrested, you're guilty. Now, to the best of my knowledge, neither of those is particularly scientific. The other thing I will say is that at least at the experiences that I and my friends have had being asked to serve on juries, one of the things that attorneys are really good at is making sure that if you know a little something about science, you're not allowed to serve. So, for example, a good friend of mine who's a geneticist who got, you know, impaneled and then got voir dired, and one of the questions was, you know, do you know something about DNA? And so he raised his hand and he said yes, and then the attorney said, well, would you say you know more than the average person about DNA? To which he responded, responded, "I know more than the average scientist about DNA." Needless to say, he was dismissed from the jury. So we have
have another tool if we want to get dismissed from juries.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that's going on here, and to say that there's this CSI effect without putting it in the context of a courtroom is probably overblowing it to some extent.
Well, so Linda, one of the sources in the documentary pointed out that, at least from his perspective, judges don't know much about science, prosecutors don't know much about science, and we could add Lee's juries don't know much about science. So, and yet we're all enamored of the notion that somehow science is going to prove somebody's guilt or innocence.
Well, I think that would, in certain cases, sway me. And it speaks to one of – Mike does extensive research on his articles and on the topics that he brings up for the show. And one of the articles is from a judge who says, "I've never seen any study that proved a CSI effect." So I went out and did a study, and he did it by interviewing – he actually got permission to do some interviews of jurors before they were selected to find out their TV viewing habits. And he said he could find no link between that the CSI effect is an effect that is professed to be true by lawyers but not necessarily proven. And I think the interesting thing about this was he said what he didn't find a correlation between people's TV viewing habits and their expectation of science, but he did find a correlation between people's technology habits, that if they had the more digital gadgets they had, smartphones and the like, that the more likely they were to expect science in their evidence.
You know, the good sign, I think, of a documentary is if it manages to tell us something new, even if we thought we knew a lot about the subject. And Lee, I wasn't surprised, and I imagine none of us around the table were surprised about sort of bite marks and the skepticism around that. Or even, you know, the notion about DNA evidence exonerating people who had been convicted using other evidence. I think we knew a lot about that. But I, at least, was surprised to hear that fingerprint analysis isn't as perfect as we like to believe it is. Or that this whole notion of the smell of death, which was used in the Casey Anthony case, had never been allowed in a murder trial before. Those things kind of were surprising and interesting to me.
The fact that the smell of death was allowed, I think that's the mistake, because the smell of death was stinky. But I, too, was surprised about the fingerprint thing, because I have no idea where I got this idea. I mean, but I actually thought that fingerprints were unique to individuals, and that the science of identifying your unique fingerprint really was science, in the sense that it was hard to make a mistake. Not impossible, but hard. And that was one of the things I picked up is, no, it's not really science. It's very educated information, but you can still goof up.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the more damning aspects I thought of the documentary had a Missouri connection to it, and that involved a group in Springfield called the American College of Forensic Examiners International, or ACFEI. They provide certificates to people who claim that they are qualified to provide expert testimony on science in court. Well, if the ACFEI isn't an outright diploma mill, it certainly seemed from the story, at least the documentary, that it needs to police its practices. Lowell Bergman, who's a famous producer and reporter and also teaches a class of journalism out at Cal Berkeley, had one of his students fill out the form, give her credit card number, and poof, she's an expert.
Well, and so it adds to that list of things that we can be credentialed in. I can now be a reverend via the internet, and now I can have a forensic expert as another title next to my name. And I think it goes well with chair of – sarcasm isn't translated over the radio here, but it's worrisome, to say the least.
I think the other thing – and I've talked to some attorneys about this – is this whole notion of expert witnesses really does go a long ways towards who has the deeper pockets and who has the more ability to subpoena. I've functioned as an expert witness in a couple of libel suits, and just the process of going through that and trying to explain to people that if you teach ethics, you can see six sides of everything, and they're not necessarily going to get what they're looking for. Experts disagree. The notion that all the experts are going to line up on one side of the line is just flawed.
Well, and it's also not just that experts would line up on one side or the other, but also that it becomes your powers of persuasion and public speaking. You can have an expert who really is the more knowledgeable, but if they are not a persuasive speaker as well, or not their testimony isn't elicited in a way that's persuasive, it almost doesn't matter.
I thought it was somewhat ironic that in the instance of the Casey Anthony trial, which is cited as one of the examples where forensic evidence can be challenged in court, that the defense attorney for Casey Anthony, who was acquitted despite, you know, many people in the media trying to, you know, convict her ahead of time, the attorney said the only reason, Lee, that he was able to successfully, in his opinion, challenge the forensic evidence from the prosecutors was the fact that ABC News paid them in a quite controversial manner $200,000 to get exclusive access to the pictures of Casey Anthony and her child.
Well, that was the single thing. I mean, the Diploma Mill thing bothered me, and I'm sorry if they're not a Diploma Mill, then I've misspoken, but it seemed that way. But this was probably the thing that bothered me the most, because our role is not to be the prosecutor. It's not to be the defense attorney. We're there to report. We're there to try to report both sides even-handedly. We're also there to report on the workings of the criminal justice system. And this seemed to me at the time, and certainly as it was portrayed in the Frontline piece, of a real violation of a lot of professional ethics, which, you know, gets you to ask, well, if my
Aren't
trial—
there five other ways to look at that, Lee? No.
at least. I mean, so what are we going to do for Mr. Zimmerman? It's like okay, we've done this once, and I do think in some senses this is a slippery slope. Every highly newsworthy trial now, are we expected to get involved because the defendant or the prosecution in one way or another doesn't have as deep a
and
pocket?
And this paying for photos, that horse is out of the barn already, because that path has been crossed so many times by organizations that you would ordinarily think are ethical, reputable news organizations, but it's gone on for this is not the first time.
Right. There's clearly a journalism education aspect to this whole story, too. If you look at the primary sources in the documentary, for example, and for much of the reporting on this type of story, comes from groups like the Innocence Project and others that are trying to expose wrongful convictions and to free people from prison who are there, even though they're innocent of the crimes they committed. Bergman, for example, has a class like that at UC Berkeley. We also remember the controversy surrounding David Protas, a professor at Northwestern University, who arguably may have gone too far with his students in trying to prove somebody's innocent. We even had our own professor, Steve Weinberg, who's tried over the years to get students here and the faculty interested in wrongful convictions. So what's the teachable moment from this? And do we need to do more of this kind of work as journalism educators?
As journalism educators, I think we need to teach our students how to do in-depth looks at the criminal justice system, and to assume that the criminal justice system is imperfect, which is not to say that it's fatally and corruptly flawed, and it certainly is not to say that it always works the way that it's supposed to. And this is the thing that I wish actually legal research, instead of doing a lot of shepherdizing of cases and figuring out what it is that the Supreme Court really meant when it dotted that I and crossed that T, actually went back and did sort of evaluation research of how is the justice system itself working.
I think that the teachable moment for students is that there aren't we like to categorize people as good guys and bad guys, and we like to categorize things as right and wrong, and that I would only report on something, you know, for good or for the betterment of society or whatever. And I think what students need to know is that there are degrees of truth, and every person, regardless of what side they're on in a journalistic story, can be obfuscating some element of the truth in their representation of what they said.
I tended to think that some of the reaction so far has been kind of black and white, even in the documentary with the prosecutors saying, oh, you're tarring, you know, all this great scientific evidence with a few bad examples. Or you have the people who are saying this proves that scientific evidence doesn't belong in a court of law because it can't be proven. It seems to me we need to be more sophisticated in how we respond to this story.
I think we need to be sophisticated in how we respond, and I think we need to also understand that science is a moving bar. The notion that, you know, we had science that could track some things 40 years ago, now we've got at least better instruments that can measure more precisely. And so there are things about science that do change.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Forensic evidence did play a role, though it hasn't been the dominant one so far, in this week's court hearing down in Jefferson City. As most of our audience probably knows, the judge there has to decide whether Ryan Ferguson, who's the former Rockbridge High School student convicted of helping murder the Columbia Tribune sports editor some years ago, deserves a new trial or not. Ferguson has always maintained his innocence. His current defense attorney is challenging key evidence from the original trial. For example, witnesses are recanting their testimony that they saw Ferguson at the scene of the killing. Even fellow convict Chuck Erickson, who originally fingered his friend Ryan Ferguson, now says he acted alone. And we even had an Illinois pathologist in the courtroom yesterday who was saying that it was probably a nail puller, not a tire iron, as the prosecutors argued that was the murder weapon. So what do we make so far, Lee, of all of this sort of disparate testimony and whether or not the media has done a good job of illustrating what's at issue here?
This is a place where I think the local media, especially the Columbia Tribune, has done a fabulous job of illustrating how ambiguous this situation is, especially 5 years gone. And you know, as an ethics person, I just love the fact that you say, okay, so do I believe a person who's now admitting that he lied? If, you know, how do I evaluate those statements? And is there anything else to buttress that? But in terms of what the local, I don't think it's been sensationalized. I think they've devoted a lot of space and staff time to it. Mm-hmm. And those things, I think, have been excellent.
I think the reading of the articles, to me, more than anything, and I'm sure there are people listening who have followed this much, much more closely than I have, but to me, reading those, it does shake your sense in our justice system. It shakes you wonder if things can be fair, if somebody has been in prison for 11 years and is now, you know, going through granting a retrial and the possibility that he is not guilty it's hard to stomach, and yet we need to wait for the process to go through.
And we absolutely still need to hear some testimony. I'll be curious to see what Kevin Crane, the former prosecutor, now current judge, has to say about the allegations that he coaxed a witness or threatened a witness into saying he saw Ferguson. And there's a lot of other testimony still to come before the judge makes up their mind. So I have to agree with you, too. I think that both the Tribune and the Missourian have done an excellent job, and we have links to collections of their stories on the blog if you'd like to, you know, see all of the writing they've been doing about that so far. Let's focus on another newspaper and a fascinating, disturbing, I'm not sure what other adjectives you'd apply to this story today, but the Los Angeles Times reported that a group of American soldiers in Afghanistan posed for pictures with the dismembered bodies of suicide bombers and men who were killed while trying to plant roadside bombs there. The story includes two photographs from 18 that were supplied by a soldier that was in that unit, and the soldier asked for anonymity. According to the Times, the battalion from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, had lost 35 men while they were deployed in Afghanistan, including at least 23 of them from bombings. Not saying that's an excuse, but that was context for the story. The Pentagon, interestingly enough, and not surprisingly, I suppose, Lee, asked the Times not to publish the photos. The paper didn't do that, but they did agree to postpone the publication for a while so that the soldiers that you can see in the pictures could be protected. So there's so many questions to ask about this. Let's just start out with, first of all, was this story about the photographs newsworthy enough to deserve front page Los Angeles Times treatment?
Absolutely. I'm only sad that I woke up to them this morning because they were a little bit of a jolt as I was pulling them up on my computer screen.
Well, let's talk a little bit then, Linda, about the use of photographs. And here's what the editor at the Los Angeles Times had to say about it. He said after, and I'm going to read the quote because I think it's important, responding to the Pentagon's, you know, insistence that they not be published. The editor's name was Devon Maharaj, and he said, "After careful consideration, we decided that publishing a small but representative selection of the photos would fulfill our obligation to readers to report vigorously and impartially on all aspects of the American mission in Afghanistan, including the allegation that the images reflect a breakdown in unit discipline that was endangering U.S. troops." Now, of course, the military says you're endangering U.S. troops by fanning the flames allegations of violence in Afghanistan by publishing them in the first place. What's your reaction to the editor's justification there?
I'm glad I didn't have to make the decision. I looked at the photos and they were horrible. They're gruesome. I think as somebody who this reminds me of the story, the U.S. soldier who is accused of gunning down citizens in the middle of the night in their beds, and we the U.S. stories and response to that were, he was a good guy, how could this have happened to him? When you see these photos, you have to have that same sense of, this is the psychology of war. This is what happens when people, you know, human beings are dehumanized, and the dehumanization comes on all sides. We're not seeing in the photographs we're not seeing the human remains of their comrades, right, who were blown up by IEDs, and these photos supposedly represent the remains of people who were in the midst of putting together bombs, who, right, were in the midst of either a suicide bomb that went awry, or were in the midst of putting together explosive devices to harm U.S. soldiers. But you look at it and to know that somebody has now reached this point at which they're so damaged by war that they could smile next to something like this is really telling. So as an editor, that photo alone tells you more than words could tell you in this story.
Does it matter at all, Lee, as the Pentagon pointed out, that these photos were taken 2 years ago? This episode happened that far in the past. Why publish them now, especially, as Linda points out, all of the context involving, you know, what our soldiers have done that's led to some violence against them?
I think Linda has it exactly right. Sometimes events happen and we act, and because we think that, oh, this is just coming out of left field, it's coming out of nowhere. The incident where the soldier went in during the night to the village and killed people, there is always a context. And so now, even though it's out of chronological order, we get a little bit of a sense about what the context is. I also think that Linda's got it exactly right, which is, you know, there but for the grace of, insert the name of your favorite deity, go all of us, because I've not been asked to go and fight in that way and to see those sorts of things. I think the Los Angeles Times did exactly the right thing. I think it was appropriate to put it on the front page, as horrible as it was. I also think they did the right thing to give the military and the Pentagon a chance to make sure that the soldiers who are identified have a chance themselves to be kept safe, at least for the time being. So, I mean, I think there were a lot of tough decisions that were made in this case pretty well.
But I also think it's inflammatory. Once those are published, I can't imagine anything but more retribution.
So pull back a little bit from this specific instance, and let's just talk, Lee, for a moment as our resident ethicist about what guidelines newsrooms should follow on whether and when to publish graphic, violent images.
I think the guidelines are in some ways they're accepted, but they're also fungible. So the first is it newsworthy? The second thing, is it newsworthy? And in this case, is it of national importance? The third is, does it tell us something that we might not otherwise know? And that's where Linda's point about, we all know war is horrible, but to see these photographs adds, I think, a dimension to that understanding. And then, of course, is it gratuitous? Have we actually considered the not just our readers and viewers and listeners, but the people who are in the photographs? Have we tried to take their views and their stake in all of this into account? And certainly, is this a way of holding up to all of us? There was one horrible result of our public policy in trying to get us to think.
And does it make any difference at all, the decision to publish them in print on the front page versus online, ethically speaking, as far as you're concerned?
I think for some news organizations, it does. I think some news organizations, this is my view, kid themselves in saying online isn't as bad because the reader has to seek it out online. My sense is publication is publication. I like the fact that they had the courage to put it on the front page.
Well, speaking about courage or whatever other motivation there was for doing good journalism, we had some of the arguably most prestigious awards in print journalism were given out this week. They were the Pulitzer Prizes. And I'm just going to describe very briefly. There's a link to all of them on our website, some of the winners. And let's talk a little bit about what, if anything, it signifies. We saw a big investigative reporting award going to the Associated Press for something we've described on this program before, and that's the AP's multi-part series on the New York Police Department and its surveillance campaign against Muslim Americans. We had the Huffington Post won a national reporting award. David Wood, who now, to be fair, I mean, he's a long-time traditional reporter, but he did a series about the toll on our soldiers, our veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan that led to a little bit of grousing in the mainstream media, at least in some corners. We had the editorial cartooning award go to Politico, an online-only news service. And even when the awards went, Linda, to some of the more traditional news organizations like the Tuscaloosa, Alabama newspaper for its coverage of the tornadoes there, they were given specific credit for the online social media that they used. Or when the Philadelphia Inquirer, again, another sort of perennial high-quality journalistic organization, they were cited partly for their use of videos. So what does that say about the Pulitzer Prize Committee looking more and more at the online contributions in these stories?
I do think that online, instead of being – we've joked a long time about new media and that new media isn't new media anymore. It's all old media. But I do think that for an organization that has traditionally only awarded print organizations I mean, that's their history. That's fine. But this begins to acknowledge that online isn't some futuristic fad that's going to pass, that it is relevant and that it adds value, that the most valuable thing isn't what comes on your doorstep the day after. It's what news organizations are able to provide in the moment that the immediacy matters.
I thought some of the sour grapes to Lee that was directed at the Huffington Post seems to me kind of misdirected, because what does it matter what the vehicle for distributing the content is? That was high quality journalism by a mainstream reporter doing that story. So what difference does it make if it's online or in print these days?
I think the difference to readers and viewers is not very much. I think the difference to journalism is deep and profound. The story that won for the Huffington Post, which it was great journalism, I think, by any definition of the term, highlights an organization that has made its substantial profit margins essentially from – so I'm going to use the ethics term and then Linda can follow up – essentially from theft.
Well, I had some conversation with Lee. So Huffington Post, what it has done primarily is it's very good at search engine optimization. It's very good at looking what's trending and finding that out and getting page views as a result of what's trending. And Huffington Post does a really good job of following up on other people's stories. Huffington Post does not have the strongest record of doing original reporting. And so I think that's where the sour grapes come from.
And even the content of the stories, there's always one story that's controversial for what's written or reported about. And this time it happens to be that AP series we talked about on the New York Police Department. And the New York Post came out with an editorial today, headline "Score One for NYPD Bashing," describes the AP's series as, quote, "a naked bid to appeal to the judge's PC sensibilities," says their one-sided narratives, you know, don't match the opinions of the people of New York who are behind the New York Police Department and anything they can do to crack down on terrorism. We don't have time to talk about it. Look at the link and maybe we'll get to it next time. But our time is up for this week. You can read more about those topics and leave a comment if you like by visiting our blog. Go to kbia.org, mouse over the talk shows tab and choose Views of the News. We also welcome your feedback via email. That address is views@kbia.org. Thanks to Lee and Linda for joining me this week, and thanks to KBIA audio engineer Pat Akers for producing our radio-only version of the show. Travis McMillan is on assignment this week, and we'll be off next week for RJI Innovation Week, but we'll all be back next Wednesday, so join us then for another edition of Views of the News.